Hi, I'm Kathy Heekin from Cincinnati, and I'm recovering one day at a time in the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. I'd like to thank Norma for inviting me here. I've never been to this part of the country before. I've never been to a place where it smells like Christmas in April. I can't, really, I can't figure out where I am, because when I look in one direction, I think I'm in North Carolina. When I look in another direction, I think I'm in Massachusetts. It's different here. It's a well-kept secret. I had no idea it was so beautiful in Oregon. I don't know why. I just never did. So it's wonderful to be here, and so far I've really, really enjoyed the conference. I would like to thank you for allowing me to bring my very dear friend Mary with me, and I would like to thank whoever it was that put that wonderful basket of food in my room. We already ate most all of it, actually, except for the mangoes, which I've never eaten before. I'm a little nervous about mangoes, but love your water. Everything's just been great. And actually, that's really how things have been for me since I've come into Al-Anon. Things just keep getting better and better when I allow them to. As Wendy said, I always find that there are a lot of similarities in stories in Al-Anon, sometimes in AA as well. There are different ways the disease, different places the disease takes us, but it certainly takes us places. It took me where I never thought I would ever be, nor where I ever thought I wanted to go. And it's through this program of Al-Anon, I believe, that I have that I've come back on track, so to speak. I was raised in a family where there was not, I don't think there was alcoholism. I can't really say that for sure. I come from an Irish Catholic background, so there was always a lot of drinking. On the periphery of my family, we always had a lot of relatives that drank too much, including my grandfather, but nobody ever would say that they were alcoholic. I mean, they were just Irish drunks, and that's all they were to us when we were kids growing up. My father was in the newscasting business and enjoyed a nice shot of bourbon at night, but it was never a problem for us. I don't know if it was a problem for him. It was never a problem for us. What was important for us as kids growing up was humor. Anything that ever went wrong or any crisis that we met, was we were always taught to deal with it in a humorous way, that if you could, you just learned to laugh things away. We were also taught that no matter what happened, everything would always turn out all right. It would always be okay. I can remember my mother would always say to us, it'll be better before you're married, or it'll be better before Christmas. And so I grew up with a strong sense that everything was going to turn out all right. We were allowed to be angry in my house as a kid. We were allowed to feel sorry for ourselves as kids, but only for about 30 seconds. And then that was it, get over it quickly and move on. That's how I was raised. I have a very close-knit family. I have there are six kids in my family. And my brothers and sisters and I, although not all of us live in Cincinnati anymore, we get together when we can once a year for a weekend together in New York City. Just the six of us. We don't bring spouses, we don't bring children, we don't bring parents. And we have a wonderful time. As a matter of fact, we plot throughout the year different times when we can all get together as a family, because we really enjoy one another's company. And a lot of that relationship is still based on humor. We have an irreverent sense of humor. We can be very, very obnoxious. And so in-laws are never offended that they're not included on these weekend jaunts, because they really don't want to be around us. It was important, I think, when I was a kid, how things looked. I have a mother who really believes that you should always be gracious, that no matter what happens, always be gracious. I can remember an incident a few months ago where one of my youngest boys put microwave popcorn in the microwave and left it. He turned it to 5 minutes and left it, and then an older brother came along as a joke and turned it up to 15 minutes. So by the time this little kid got his popcorn, it was charred. And my mother heard the story, and she said to my youngest one, "You know what I would have done? I would have eaten that charred popcorn, and I would have said, 'Oh, I just love it this way. Oh, this is so good. This is my favorite way to eat it. I think I'll char it from now on.'" And you know, when I heard her say that to my little boy, I thought, you know, that's how I was raised. That no matter what anybody did to you, or no matter what they said, pretend like it doesn't bother you. Always be gracious, no matter what. That's what was important. And I think also, I've had well over 16 years of a Catholic education, and I was taught by lovely nuns. I know not everybody got lovely nuns, but I got them. And they always, you know, they always had this idea, they always taught me the importance of putting myself last. I had this little old nun in high school that used to say, the secret to joy, J-O-Y, was putting Jesus, others, and then yourself last, J-O-Y. And she used to always teach us that, you know? And somewhere along the line, I got the idea that what was really important was how things were going for you, how you felt. If you were upset, I knew it was my job to straighten things out for you. If you were sad, I knew it was my job to make you happy. And I always focused on you and not on me. And I don't know that that's such a bad way to live, but it got me in trouble. It got me in trouble. I was a kid that was raised in such a way that I always followed the rules. Looking good and being right were always important to me. And those are two things that still to this day cause me trouble. Looking good and being right. And I always thought if you just followed the rules and did what you were told to do, everything would work out. But I was always attracted to people that broke the rules. I was always attracted to people that didn't care what anybody said or thought, that didn't care how things looked. I've often said that if Saddam Hussein had been a foreign exchange student when I was in high school, I would have wanted to date him. Just the kind of guy that I was attracted to. And so when I met my husband, I just thought he was the most exciting romantic man I'd ever met in my life. He was in training to be a jet pilot for the Marines. And he would say exactly what was on his mind. And he would tell you exactly what he thought of you. And he never cared how things looked. And so I thought that he would do for me what I could never do for myself, you know? Because I'd never tell you what I thought, because I didn't want to offend you. See, I was arrogant enough to think that if I told you what I thought, I could ruin your day. So, as Wendy said, you know, when we decided to get married, it really wasn't. It wasn't so much of a decision I made. We were having dinner at his family, with his family, and I at the time was teaching school in Chicago, and he at the time was in training in Pensacola, Florida. And it was around Christmas time, and his whole family was assembled at dinner. He comes from a big family as well. There's seven kids in his family. And he said, I've got an announcement to make. I had no idea what he was going to say. And I thought maybe he'd gotten a, you know, he was going to be a lieutenant or something. And he said, Kathy and I are going to get married. And I thought, oh my God, I didn't know he was going to say that. But what could I do? I mean, how would it look if I said, we are? Or that's news to me. So I thought, well, you know, I guess we were going to get married. I mean, I assumed that's where this relationship was going to lead. And so I went along with it. Now today that seems crazy to me, but then that's really how I operated. I was always willing to allow you to make those decisions. Because if you made the decisions, I could never be wrong. If you made those decisions, you were responsible for them, not me. Not me. And so we got married, and we moved immediately to North Carolina. I mean, we got married, and right after the ceremony, we headed for North Carolina because he was now stationed at Cherry Point, which is in Havelock, North Carolina. It's a Marine Corps Air Station. And I knew 10 days into my marriage that I was in over my head. I knew that quickly that I was in trouble. Because my husband and I, when we were dating, you know, there would be these blow-ups. And I never knew when they were coming, and I never knew what they were about. But I always thought that once we lived together, that would go away. Because I was just such an easy person to live with, you know, and whatever was troubling him, oh, I could fix it. I mean, you know, in my house, we spent a lot of time laughing, and that's all he needed. He just needed a little bit of this Irish Catholic humor of mine, you know, that's all he needed. And once I lived with him on a daily basis, he'd be taken care of. So 10 days in, I know I'm in trouble, and what happened was this, and I tell this story often because it really, I'll give you an idea of what happened for the next 12 and a half years. We had received a gift in the mail, and it was some sort of glassware, I forget what it was, glasses or glass plates, and they arrived in a box, they were all packed in straw, and so he was away flying, and I opened up the gift and put away all the glasses and put the box and all the straw in the garbage can. We were living in a trailer camp at the time. I mean, it was really a trailer camp. Wasn't a trailer park, you know, with landscaping. I mean, we were on cinder blocks, and That's where we were, so I wasn't too concerned about the yard. But at any rate, so I threw this box away with the straw. And when he came home, I said, we got a wedding gift in the mail today. And he said, did you open it? And I said, yeah. He said, was it addressed to both of us? And I said, well, yeah. He said, don't you know it's against federal regulations to open up somebody else's mail? Well, I thought that was strange. I mean, I thought, what is he talking about? But you know, I always go into that. See, I always like to get along. I hate confrontation. I don't like trouble. I like harmony. So I thought, well, maybe that's what you do when you get married. I mean, we'd only been married 10 days. Maybe you do things together, and maybe I have to start thinking in terms of we and not in terms of I, and maybe I just have a lot to learn about this marriage thing. And then he said, and there's straw all over the side yard. Well, I thought, my God, I mean, we're living in a camp. I mean, the straw's a good thing. The birds will take it. They'll build nests. Who cares? And, I mean, it's the 60s. Who cares? And he said, pick it up. You know, you need to go out there and pick it up. And, you know, there was something in me that thought, this isn't right. I mean, this isn't normal. But I was willing to do that, you know. I was just wanted for it to be okay. So I went outside, and I picked up the straw, and when I tried to get back into the trailer, the door was locked. And, you know, I knocked on the door, and, you know, Ricky, it's your bride. And he said, you missed some. Well, see, that's what I thought. I thought, oh, this is too strange. So I left. I left. And I walked down along the highway, and I had nothing. All I had on was this apron. And, I mean, I had my clothes on underneath the apron. I wasn't that risque yet. And so there was nothing open. It was like 6:30 or 6:45, and I was in North Carolina. I'd only been there for 10 days, and I'm thousands of miles from home or anybody that I know. And I got into this furniture store, and I just walked around this furniture store. I walked around the couches and the end tables and the lamps, and I thought, you got to get out of here. I mean, that was my first instinct. You've got to get out of here. There's something wrong. This is something bad. And all the jokes in the world, you know, and all the humor and all the isn't going to make this right. This is a bad, dangerous thing. And I was scared. I mean, I can remember that feeling so well. It was like, you know, icy fingers had a hold of my intestines. And I thought, you got to get out of here. You got to wait till tomorrow when he goes away and he goes off to fly somewhere and get a check and get to New Bern, North Carolina, and you fly home to Cincinnati. Get out of here. But, you know, the second thought was one that held me in place for years. And that was, how's that going to look? You've been married 10 days. What are you going to say? I mean, they'll think you're an idiot. That'll be a story that'll follow you for the rest of your life. Oh, there goes Kathy Fogarty. She's married for 10 days and came home. I mean, I didn't want to be the butt of jokes, for God's sakes. And so this thinking, you know, you made your bed, you lie in it, you better make the best of it, blah, 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 blah. What I started to do was, of course, talk myself out of my instincts. And I learned to do that well over the next 12 and a half years. I just talked myself out of my instincts. And I took that fear, and I took that anger, and that resentment, and that constant feeling of this is not fair, and I just shoved them down. I just swallowed it. I swallowed it. Because I didn't know what else to do. And so I acted as if. I acted as if it was just fine, it was okay, it was no big deal. And I walked back to that trailer, and I picked up the straw, and he opened the door, and that was that. Now, you know, what was dangerous about that was I was angry at him, but more damagingly, I was angry with myself. Because what I really felt like doing was with my brute strength, pushing that trailer right off the cinder blocks with him in it. But see, I'd never do that, because that's just not gracious, you know? How would that look? So I picked up the straw. Things like that didn't happen all the time. As a matter of fact, they didn't happen even every other day. But they happened enough that I always lived in a state of confusion. They happened enough that I always lived with my foot, with one foot in the marriage and one foot out the door. It happened enough that I would always say to myself, is this it? Is this the event? Is this the insult? Is this the humiliation that's great enough to break up this marriage? Is this the day I should leave? Or is this something that I should just swallow and move on with? And I never was sure. I just never knew. I never knew what to do. I had absolutely no tools. And I'd always go back to what I had been taught, you know. Maybe I'll just be able to outlast this thing. Maybe I'll just outweigh it. And I spent years trying to accommodate alcoholism. Years trying to accommodate alcoholism. And what happened was is it just didn't work. And what happened was my tolerance for intolerable behavior just grew until I ended up with absolutely no respect for myself. With no respect for myself. Now, my husband had orders to Vietnam, and we knew that when we got married in January, but we just didn't know when those orders were going to come through. We were married in January, he got his orders in March, and I was absolutely thrilled. I just couldn't wait for him to leave. Now, I knew that wasn't a normal response for a bride, but I couldn't tell anybody that. I couldn't tell that to those other military wives who were all wringing their hands and what are we going to do for that year when our husbands are gone. I had to sit there and wring my hands with them because I knew that that's what I should be feeling. I should be feeling anxious. I should be feeling sorrow, but I wasn't. I was thinking, oh God, it'll be great. He'll be gone for a year and then I'll be able to figure this thing out. If I can just get some distance, I'll be able to figure this whole thing out. But not before, of course, I would lecture him about the immorality of the Vietnam War. See, I always thought that I was the keeper of truth and justice in this relationship. And it was very important for me to speak to him about this and about that. And finally, he'd just get up out of bed and say, I'm not sleeping with a communist. And he would go in the living room and sleep on the couch. But not before he would turn on, at full blast, Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man. You know, and the whole trailer would be rocking back and forth to that lousy Tammy Wynette, you know, Stand By Your Man. Oh, it was just like a nightmare for me. I used to have all these crazy thoughts during those months. I'd think, well, you know, you had a happy childhood. You can't expect to have a happy adulthood. You know, this is just God's way of balancing out your life. And, oh, so finally he left for Vietnam in April. And I went back to Cincinnati, and I went home to live with my parents, and I just loved being back home again. I just loved it. But I wasn't home more than 20 minutes than when I called the priest that had married us, because I needed to talk to somebody. And I was walking out the door, and my mother said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going down to talk to Father Railing. And she said, I hope you're not going to tell him anything personal. You know, that's that generation. Oh, no, don't worry, Mom. I thought, oh, my God. That was my first trip to somewhere to try to find out what was wrong. What could I do to fix this? And he suggested I just try not to be so aggressive or assertive. But I never mentioned the drinking, you know. I never mentioned the drinking because I never made a connection with drinking. I never made a connection with drinking. I just thought my husband was turning mean. And when people would say to me when he was in Vietnam, gee, aren't you worried about him? Gee, aren't you afraid that he's going to get shot down? I'd always say, no, I don't worry about him because he's such an excellent pilot. And he was an excellent pilot. But that's not why I wasn't worried. I wasn't worried because I just figured he was too mean for them to ever shoot down. I mean, they'd always shoot down those nice little boys from Oregon. That's who they would get, not these guys. They never got caught. But I used to think, you know, it would be a good thing perhaps if he were shot down and not killed, but just tortured a little bit. And maybe... maybe that would be the spiritual experience that he needed that would just straighten him out. See, my focus was always on him. It was never on me. I never once thought about, what are you doing living in this situation? It was never. It was just if he would straighten up, if he would act right, then everything would be okay. He came back from Vietnam, and we continued in the military. And I don't know, but it seems to me that if I were an alcoholic, the military would be a great place to go because there's a lot of alcohol, and it's cheap, and a lot of people drink it, particularly those that fly, unfortunately, because a lot of them fly now for the major airlines. But, you know, they do. I used to watch my husband when he drank because I used to think that if I could just keep track of how much he was drinking, then I could know how to act. You see, I was constantly adjusting. You know, the more he drank, the quieter I became. And I was so afraid he would get a drink in that I didn't see, and then I wouldn't be quiet enough. I just learned to lay very, very low when he was drinking. And I always knew it was important to see how he was so then I would know how to be. If he was in a good mood, well then, daggone, I better take advantage of it and I'll get in a good mood. And if he was in a bad mood, I steered clear. I kept very, very, very quiet. I thought that was brilliant on my part. It never occurred to me not to get into a car with somebody that was drinking. Never. Because if I didn't get into a car with him coming home from a squadron party, I'd have to ask you for a ride home. And how would that look? How disloyal not to get into a car with my drunk husband. That's what I thought, you see. And so I'd get in the car and I'd carry a rosary in my pocket and I would seatbelt myself in and I would pray. And I thought that was being smart. And I also knew never to tell him he was going 90 miles an hour, because I did that once, and then we went 120 miles an hour. So I learned to keep my mouth closed because I was afraid. And I lived with fear for a long time. But almost all my decisions during all those years were rooted and based on fear. I was just always afraid and always anxious. And I had no idea how fearful I was, how anxious I was, and how angry I was, because that was never okay. That was never okay to be a fearful person. It was never okay to be an angry person. And God knows it was never okay to be a resentful person. I just wasn't raised that way. And it was never who I intended to be. So my husband, when he got out of the military and he became a dentist. Don't ask me. I don't know. Became a dentist. But right before he went to dental school, before we went up to Ohio State, he linked up with a Vietnam buddy, and they went over to Newport, Kentucky, and drank and were beaten badly by bouncers at a bar over there. And he had to have plastic surgery before dental school because this bouncer had used brass knuckles on my husband's face, and it had pretty well screwed up his eye. And it's a good idea to have your eyes if you're going to be a dentist. So those years in dental school, that was it. No drinking. That was it. I didn't know what had happened. All I knew is that there was no drinking, and my life changed. Things got better. Things got really, really good. We got involved with a church group, you know, this marriage couple group in our church. Things were great. And I thought it was because I had outlasted whatever that was. I just hung in there long enough. Thank God for me. Oh my God, thank God I'm such a patient, kind person. Here's the payoff. He's not drinking. He's in dental school. He's getting great grades. We're having babies. We're working with the church. Everything's great. I'm so happy. I can't stand it. I'm so proud of me. Look what I've done. Am I a remarkable woman or what? We move back to Cincinnati and everything changes. Everything is awful once more, and I don't know why. Because what I don't know is now that my husband's writing prescriptions for himself to medicate himself. But I didn't know that. See, I'm good at alcohol because I can smell it and I know the signs. But prescription drugs, I missed him. I just thought he was going crazy and I didn't know what to do. So what I did was I tried to get good, because that's always my response. If something's wrong, I'll just get real good. I'll just start praying. I'll start lighting candles. I'll start sprinkling holy water all over the bed. I'll pray when he's asleep with my hands over his head. I'll do anything. I'll say rosaries with my hands up in the air. I'll just get good. And when that doesn't work, I'm lost. I'm lost. That's always my response. Go 90 miles an hour and get good, and that'll fix it. And it didn't fix it. And it didn't fix it. And things got really, really bad. And eventually, of course, the renew agents, the drug people, caught him, threw him out of dentistry, and then he returned to drinking. And years of unemployment. And unemployment scares me. It frightens me, especially when you have a house load of kids. Now, it's not true to say that he was not employed completely, because he did take up fox hunting. Now, I'm sure that in the 1700s, that was probably a lucrative profession. By the 1970s and 1980s, you don't make a lot of money selling fox furs. But he gave it his best, you know. He'd go out with his guns, and we always had guns in our house, in our bedroom. We always had those long guns. I don't even know what they are to this day, but they all hung on racks. And some days when he just couldn't make it out of bed, he'd just lay in bed with the windows open, and he would just shoot right out the window. Whatever was in the trees, you know, the birds, squirrels, I mean, they would just go in pieces. And my response to this was, of course, I was always trying to normalize things. Because I didn't want you to think that I was in over my head. I didn't want you to think that I couldn't handle the situation. And so I would run outside to the kids and say, "Don't play on that side of the house today. Dad's hunting. Take all your friends and go over to that side of the house where the garden is. Look at that." You see, my pride, I mean, I never wanted you to think that I couldn't handle it. And I never wanted you to think that I was unhappy. And I never wanted my mother and father to know what I was living with. I felt that it was my obligation and duty to protect them from the truth of my life. I also thought it was my duty to continue to look good. I didn't want you to think I didn't know what to do. I had no answers. And I was fueled all the time by people who would say, only you could be married to him. You know, that would just keep me going for weeks and weeks and weeks. But the truth of the matter was, I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. I was panicked. And where we were living at the time was on a lot of property that my husband's family owned. And if you look, things looked good. We lived in a beautiful house next to the main house where his parents lived. And there was a pool in my yard, and I had tennis courts, and stables, and horses, and it looked great. But inside, we were eating generic brands. We had cheese that a friend of my husband's had gotten from running a scam on government food stamps. And we're drinking powdered milk. It was just bizarre. I just didn't want you to know that. I just didn't want you to know that, and that's how things were. And people were moving in, you know, out on this land. There were suburbs, encroaching suburbs, and so all these normal people were moving into the neighborhood, and they wouldn't let their kids play at my house, because my house, of course, was surrounded with leg hold traps. And I used to make fun of these women, you know. I used to call them the Stepford Wives. And, you know, don't they know if their kid steps in a leg hold trap, all you do is open it up and pull the kid's leg out and everything's fine? And then they would call me. You know, they'd be missing their cats. And I had a funny feeling where those cats were. You know, late at night, you know, my husband would be shooting guns, and he wasn't always shooting fox. And I knew there were a couple of neighbors' cats in my garden, you know, that were making my roses grow beautifully. But I just was always living in fear that somebody would find out the truth of my life. And I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know where to go. And finally, on this property that my family owned, most of my husband's family lived there as well. It was somewhat like a compound. Eventually, one of my sisters-in-law joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and that pretty much screwed it up for everybody. It did! You know? She went into AA, then another sister went into AA. It was like the domino theory. She went into AA, then that sister went into AA, then that sister went into AA, then that brother-in-law went to Al-Anon, blah, 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 blah. And they'd always come up to my kitchen. And I don't know if you know what it's like when people get into AA and they come around and you know they're coming for you. I mean, you just know they're coming for you. They start in with the talk, and I thought, oh, my God, they're coming for me. And I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to go to Al-Anon. I didn't want to have anything to do with that. I just didn't want to go to one more place, because I had been going to places 3 months into my marriage. When my husband left for Vietnam, I went to the priest, and I had never stopped. I'd been to social workers. I'd been to psychiatrists. I'd been to psychologists. I'd been all over the place, and nothing changed, and nothing helped, and I was done with it. And I thought, if he wants to join something, he can go ahead. But I'm through. I'm through. There's nothing wrong with me. If he wants help, he can get help for himself. But one thing changed my idea, and that was this. I'd always had this 8-year plan. My husband was 4 years older than I was, and usually in the United States, women outlive men by about 4 years. So I always thought that at the end of my life, I'd have about 8 years. And those 8 years, you know, I would do whatever I wanted to do. I would live peacefully. I wouldn't have to worry about what he was doing. I wouldn't have to cover up. I wouldn't have to lie. I wouldn't have to pretend. I wouldn't have to live with those icy fingers that still had my intestines. It would just be so peaceful. And now his sisters are talking about this being a family disease, how it's been in their houses for generation upon generation. And I'm getting nervous, you know, because my 8-year plan is being threatened. Because when all this has happened, I'm pregnant with our 7th child. And what the hell's the matter with you? Don't you have kids in Oregon? What the hell's the matter with them? And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'll never get away from this. I'll never get away from this bizarre, crazy behavior. What am I going to do? And that scared me. The fear of the future scared me enough that I was willing to swallow my pride and just find out about this Al-Anon. I was just going to go and find out. But I went to a meeting that was so far away from where I lived. Really, I thought I was going to have shots. I went as far away as I could. I didn't want anybody to know I was going there. I wasn't quite sure my husband was an alcoholic. It wasn't like he drank every day. Sure, when he drank, he got drunk. Sure, he was as mean as a snake. Sure, he'd gotten mixed up with drugs and all that stuff. Sure this, sure that. But I wasn't sure he was an alcoholic. See, in my mind, an alcoholic is somebody that drinks every day, sits on the curbside, drinks out of a brown bag. My husband used to drink out of silver monogram cups. How could he be an alcoholic? I didn't want to be wrong about this, you know what I mean? I wanted to be right. So I was nervous about going. So I went, and I went to my first meeting, and went to a beginner's meeting, and this woman said to me, same thing I heard last night. Alcoholism is a disease that you didn't cause, you can't cure, and you can't control. Now, I never thought that I'd cause my husband's drinking, but by God, I always believed that I should be able to cure it. I always believed that if I loved him well enough and loyally enough and unconditionally, he'd straighten up. And when that didn't happen, I didn't know what to do. See, I always thought there was reasons. You know, I always thought there were reasons for his drinking. I always felt that way about my relatives. When I was having a lot of babies and I would wean them, you know, after I'd nurse them, my Irish grandmother said to me that in Ireland, the way they used to wean their babies is they would take their fingers and run it through the soot of fireplaces, you know, the soot of the fireplace, and they would draw this horrible picture on the end of their bosom. And that would scare the kids so badly that they wouldn't want to nurse anymore. And I would think to myself, my God, no wonder all the Irish drink. That seems pretty simple to me. You know, and I was always doing the same thing with my husband. I was always thinking of excuses. Well, it's this. Well, it's that. Well, it's this. Well, it's that. And now this woman tells me it's a disease, and I got nothing to do with it. I've got nothing to do with it and can do nothing. And that first meeting for me, which happened to be April the 5th, 1982, was absolutely the best news I'd ever heard in my life. I think I did cartwheels going out of that meeting. I was so relieved because for the first time somebody told me, it's not your job. It's not your job. And I always thought it was my job to hold everything together. And this woman, this little gray-haired woman, is saying, mind your own business. And then she said something to me that I've never forgotten, and that was this. Al-Anon is for you. Regardless of what your husband may or may not do, Al-Anon is for you. And you need to come back for yourself. I went out into the main meeting with these other men and women, much like yourselves, and I began to listen. I didn't say much when I started out. I began to listen. And it became very clear to me that these were men and women who were living as though they had choices in their lives. And that was news to me, because I thought that everything that I did and everything that I said, I did because I had to. I had no choices. I had no choices. And they're acting as if they had choices. And they were making different choices than the ones that I had been making. And they were in a good place. And they weren't getting into cars with people who were drinking. They weren't setting themselves up. And they were taking charge and responsibility of their own lives. And they taught me some very valuable slogans in the beginning. They said, let go and let God. Let go and let God. I loved that slogan. I would go home and I wouldn't cook. I wouldn't make beds. I wouldn't do anything. I didn't know where my kids were. I let go and I let God. I didn't care. It was wonderful for me. And I, of course, took it to an extreme. I didn't care about anything. I got on the phone. I talked to these new friends of mine. I read a lot of literature. I was so relieved. And they also taught me this other wonderful slogan, which was, you could be right. You could be right. I'd never said that in my whole life to him. But now they're telling me it's not my job to straighten him out, that his recovery is between him and his higher power, and I had to get out of the way. And so when I would go home, and a comment that at one time would have sparked a lecture from me for an hour, you know, anything, I think my sister is crazy or something like that, now I say, you could be right. And then I'd walk away. I mean, that was a revolutionary thing in my house. I just wouldn't get into it because you told me I didn't have to, that I could walk away. You could be right. And it also annoyed him, which was another bonus. And now I've got all this time on my hands, you see, because I'm not into it. I'm not fighting. I'm not lecturing. I got all this time in my hands to do things that were really fun. I do this meeting the first Thursday of every month at this detox center in downtown Cincinnati. And just this past Thursday night, one of the family members of somebody that was in there said, when they get out of here and now they're sober, what are they going to do with all that time that they used to use to drink? And I said to her, don't worry about what they're going to do. What are you going to do with all that time that you're going to have? I mean, that's the question. Because all of a sudden, I got all this time on my hands to do things that I really enjoyed, to do things for me, to begin my own recovery. And that was so important. You see, I didn't know my life was unmanageable until I met you. And you showed me through the way that you were living. You showed me because you kept coming to meetings and showed up and shared your strength and your hope and your experience. And through that, you showed me that my life was unmanageable and that I was absolutely powerless over alcoholism. And I didn't know that until I met you. I also didn't know and didn't realize how insane my own life had become. And I met a woman early on that said to me, Kathy, you'll never get better until you can admit yourself how sick you are, how full of fear, how full of anger, and how full of resentment. And I was so mad when she said that to me. I thought, lady, you come home with me and meet Genghis Khan if you want to see sick and angry. But you see, I never noticed that. You know, I heard a story one time it was an educational convention about the day that this big block of marble was delivered to the door of Michelangelo's home, and he took it into his backyard, and every day he began to chip away at it. And a little kid from next door watched him every day chip away at this big block of marble until one day Michelangelo had created the statue of David. And a little kid came through the bushes and said to Michelangelo, how'd you know that guy was in there? And I always think of that in relation to Al-Anon because, you know, I always had an idea of the kind of woman that I wanted to be. I always, as a kid, believed in this woman. And largely it was based upon my grandparents, my grandmothers, and my own mother, of this woman that I believed that God had called me to be. And it was always a woman of compassion and a woman of grace and a woman of joy and a woman of gentleness. And boy, I'll tell you, alcoholism just took that dream away from me. Alcoholism just robbed me of that dream. It robbed me of my hopes. It robbed me of my joy. It robbed me of my spontaneity. It just hollowed me out. It just hollowed me out. And you are the ones that returned that dream to me. You are the ones, through the way that you work these 12 steps, you are the ones that gave me back that idea of that kind of woman that I want to be one more time. And you told me that the absolute importance of turning my life and will over to the care of God. That had to be done, the importance of that third step. I mean, I've always believed in a God, but I just never, my idea of God has changed dramatically since I've been in. I always believed in a God that loved me because I followed the rules, because I did what I was told to do, because I was a good kid, because I never was angry and I never said an unkind word. I kept it all bottled inside. But you know what? Boy, I had turned into inside I was raging. Inside, I was just raging, and I had long ago lost the idea of that kind of woman that I wanted to be. I'd given up on her, and if I had met me years ago, I would never have chosen me as a friend for myself. I would not have liked me, and that's a terrible thing to say, because alcoholism robbed me of my dignity as a human being, and that's a terrible loss. But you showed me how to recover what I had lost. And I had to do it by turning my life and will over to the care of God. I don't understand all the things in this world. I really don't. I don't understand why in a world of plenty we have so many people, you know, that die from hunger. And I don't know how it is in Seaside, Oregon, but in Cincinnati we're losing so many of our youths to violence and drugs. And I don't understand that. And I don't understand why at the end of the line God would send me three boys whose teenage years are going to coincide with my menopausal years. I don't understand that. What could that be about, you know? But you have taught me that I need to turn my life and will over to a care of God. And you have taught me to believe in a God who is on time. I believe on an on-time God, and that God works on time for me. And I believe today in a God not of success, but in a God of failure. A God who is closest to me in my brokenness and in my failure, in my honesty with myself and in my humility to know that I can only do so much, that this is a we thing, that I must always cooperate, you know, by turning things over, by the power of surrender. And I believe today in a God who can bring good out of evil and who can bring order out of chaos and who can bring serenity and peace out of disruption. That's what I believe today. And nothing really changed for me until I got a sponsor, until I had made a fourth step. That's when things really changed for me in this program. When I found a sponsor who worked the steps with me, not in somebody that told me how to live my life particularly or gave me advice, but somebody who shared with me how she works those 12 steps in her own life, that's when things began to change. I always would tell you how it was like to live with him, but I never once thought about what it was like to live with me. And our literature says that we have a murderous armory of weapons that destroy love and respect. And I had a huge armory. I used sarcasm, I used coldness, I was the queen of ice, you know. I would just cut him off and treat him as though he were invisible. That's what I did. And he became for me a tremendous source of material to use. I'd make fun of him all the time. I'd tell terribly funny stories about my husband. And you know, I was never raised really to make fun of sick people. And the damage I did to myself through my own actions was great. It was great indeed. But that's what I had to do in that fourth step, you know. I had to be willing to let go of things that had been done to me. I had to be willing to forgive those in my life who hurt me only because they were sick, and I had to learn to treat them with patience, with kindness and understanding because they were sick, and I had to take responsibility for my part in what I had done, my actions. And that's what the fourth step brought to me. You know, in Ohio, we have a terrible, terrible habit, cruel habit, of making fun of people who live in Kentucky. It's a terrible thing. I don't know. It's just I try to break myself of it. But you know, there's this couple that live in Kentucky, and they live very, very primitively in the hills. And they have no modern-day conveniences. They have no indoor plumbing. They have no electrical appliances. They don't even have a mirror in their home. They live in a two-room shack. And this woman suspected that her husband was carrying on an affair, because he'd leave the shack every day at the same time for a couple of hours. He'd go off in the woods, and she thought to herself, I know he's carrying on with another woman. I'm going to follow him. So one day she did follow him, and she followed him to this little one-room place in the woods, and she peered through the windows, and she saw him in there, and he was just sitting by himself. But he took something down from the shelf, and he had it in his hand, and then he returned it, and then he left. And when she was sure he was gone, she went in there, and she went up, and she pulled down what was on that shelf. And here it was a mirror. And she looked in it, and she said, ha! So that's that ugly hag he's been carrying on with. And you know, I never looked at me. I never looked at me. I never did that. I always was looking at him. And that's what the fourth step gave me. It allowed me to look at me. And to take responsibility once for my own health and my own happiness, and to share that with another human being, with God, with myself, what a freedom, what an absolute freedom to be free of that life of blaming and shaming. Wow, you know, I take my kids in the summer to Cape Cod, and I was up there last summer, and when I got there, I called the Al-Anon office and said, where is there a meeting? And they said, Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, Methodist Church, Chatham. Know exactly where it was, Tuesday, 7 o'clock, I'm there. There's no meeting. I'm walking all around the churches, banging on door, there's no meeting. And you know what the first thing I thought was? This would never happen in AA. Really? I did. I thought, this would never happen if this were AA. There'd be a meeting, somebody'd show up. Why is this? I was really mad. And I thought to myself, you know, we get missed in Al-Anon. I got missed. My husband's behavior was so outrageous and so out there. Nobody missed him. I got missed. I even missed me. I never insulted anybody's wife. I never got in the midst of a bar fight. I never got picked up for DUI. I never lost my profession because of an addiction. But I was so sick. But I spent so much time looking good, I got missed. And you know, this disease is fatal to me. It's not just fatal to him. I'm never going to die of cirrhosis of the liver, but I'm going to die another way, a way that I think is uglier. I'm going to die bitter, I'm going to die blaming, and I'm going to die alone. That's what happens to somebody like me. And that, to me, is a terrible way to go. And so I have to get serious about my recovery, because this disease is real to me. It's very real to me. And oftentimes in Cincinnati, those in my Al-Anon group, we talk about the A team and the B team, you know, which I think is the funniest thing. The A team, of course, are those in AA, and we're in the B team, you know. Somebody called us once an auxiliary. Which is so funny because a lot of us are so much sicker than the alcoholic because we get missed. We get missed. I got missed. And that sixth step tells me that I have to be entirely ready to have God remove those defects of character that alcoholism just acted like a fertilizer on. I mean, my defects of character, my looking good, my, you know, having to be right, they just mushroomed when faced with the disease of alcoholism. They grew by leaps and bounds. And if I don't take care of that or do something about that, I'm going to die a horrible death. And I know women that have gone out that way, bitter and lonely, and it's an ugly thing to watch. And I don't want to go that way. I keep my eye on those women, and I don't care what program they're in. I keep my eye on those women who are recovering. And I pay attention to them, and I want to be with them. And that's who I spend my time with. Because I can't afford to be around women that complain, that blame, that tear down, that judge, and that shame. 'Cause